Thanks, John. Right, so I'm going to talk about the Vietnam games which America ran during the 1960s and lessons we can learn from them. Right, so what I'll be talking about is the Sigma series of games, which were a set of seminar games. The Rural Agile Coin Game, the Urban Coin Game, which were both sort of proto-mega games, and then the Tactical War Game, which John mentioned earlier. And finally, why these games still matter and why they're worthy of research and study. So, like I say, John says, I'm currently a PhD student at Bath Spa, been hobby gamer for years, and I've got a job in commercial hobby game design, which I've recently taken up, which has proved to be very interesting and quite illuminating, seeing how that side of the industry works. And there's an obligatory disclaimer as well at the end there. So, America's games about the Vietnam War. The games covered quite a lot of, well, all of the scales really, from large strategic games through to games looking at different aspects of counterinsurgency procedure down to tactical combat. The seminar games, the Sigma series, were really to develop strategy and provide a sort of roadmap of potential futures. The multiplayer games were to give players experience of day-to-day counterinsurgency activities and how to interact with the indigenous population of a country. And the Tactspiel was a tactical game looking at air mobility, which really came into its own in the Vietnam War. So the Sigma series, they were high-level games with a large amount of players in them. They were extensively researched and prepared, with upwards of 40-plus people writing the scenarios, briefings, and materials. The players, it had sufficient high-level buy-in. There was various levels of command from the White House, Pentagon, and the intelligence agencies all represented in the players. It was a typical sort of Kriegsspiel we're all used to, with a white control team, a red cell, and a blue cell. The red cell was again fully staffed with qualified people who'd previously had good jobs in relevant fields, so they could give valuable feedback on and a well-reasoned response to what the blue cell was doing. The games were run at the classified level, and like I said, the series' intent was to map out situations and possible futures as the war was developing in Southeast Asia. Now, if we look at the list of the series of games, you see we start with Sigma 162 back in 1962, well before the official start of the Second Indochina War and American intervention. This game was commissioned under the Kennedy administration by people wanting to examine what was happening there and how the insurgency in South Vietnam was starting. This was, to put it in historical context, Kennedy had a deep interest in counterinsurgency and special forces warfare. And after Khrushchev's comment about supporting wars of national liberation, this was something which was a cause for concern at the time. So as the games developed, we started looking at longer term prospects of the war, escalatory prospects, including strategic bombing, the efficacy of a bombing campaign, and then looking at negotiation and de-escalation at the end. As you'll notice, a lot of these games prefigure what happened in real life by a couple of years, which is interesting in itself and is a good guide as to what the American thinking was at the time. So, from the Sigma games, you've got the lessons learned and the lessons not learned. Given the amount of preparation and buy-in from people attending the games, obviously taken seriously, However, given that the situations which appeared in the games mirrored what happened in real life, for example, one of the games had American involvement in Vietnam be revealed by a shoot down of an American aviator over Laos, and the same happened a few years later. The failure of the Rolling Thunder campaign to seriously curtail the involvement of the North Vietnamese was again came out of a game before the campaign itself was launched. The some of the later games found the Americans bogged down in a quagmire by 500,000 troops in 1970 and no chance of winning. Again, this seems very familiar. And again, the various locations of battles appeared in the games, happened in real life as well. But obviously, these games are indicative but not predictive. So you've got to question why these games are so successful. And these games are sort of one-off events. And from reading the game files that I have, I do think they just showed the most likely outcome. And what happened in real life was the most likely outcome as well. So you had certain opinions which weren't changed by the game, such as people's belief in strategic bombing still being effective, when in reality the amount of material needed to support an insurgency is very small. So interdiction strategies which relate back to World War II aren't really applicable in this thing, against all the other arguments against strategic bombing as well. So I think one of the big lessons of this, and I'll come back to it at the end, is if you're going to have a game, listen to the outcome of the game. If you've sponsored it and you don't like the result, that's your problem, not the game's problem. The game may very well represent the most likely outcome. So we'll move on to one of the smaller level games, the Rural Agile Coin War game of 1966. This is a large game, multiplayer, which anyone who's played a Mega game will recognise a format. Three teams of players, groups of civilians, each representing a village, and then American team and a VC team. The American team could visit the village in the day turn, the VC team in the night turn. Yeah. And they were meant to get information and, if possible, with the set ambushes for the other side, and the civilians were sort of stuck in the middle and had to be interacted with. Of course, the civilians could inform one or other of the sides if the other side had laid an ambush, and this then dictated how each side interacted with the players. Now, again, this sounds like a very sensible setup, and the game was well structured in that way. The failure of this game was really one, for me, of facilitation, in that there was no rules of engagement given for the Americans. I mean, you can make comparisons to Free Fire Zone if you want, but that game doesn't really study this. And the American behavior towards the civilians was very poor in the game and not pulled up on. In one run of the game, it was run five or six times, one civilian village actually abandoned their station and fled to the mountains, so sick of being abused by both sides of the team of the game. At that point, you've got to wonder why the game wasn't stopped and a debrief conducted as to the lessons learned at this point, because I don't think continuing at that point is anything useful to teach people. Again, one of the other problems I think from this is the failure really of red teaming. There isn't really sufficient detail to go into the motivations of the Viet Cong and civilian side. All the players were Americans, and I think they were pretty much chosen by who was available at the time. And with inadequate briefing, I don't think that helped. And again, I think a degree of lack of cultural awareness in this game really shows. The urban coin game was relatively similar, but obviously set in an urban situation. The population was split up into, the population players were split up into various classes. So it did attempt some sort of cultural and class-based analysis of the population base. They had to go through their day-to-day activities, moving from area to area, depending if they had a job or not, or if they did have a job, which sort of job they did have. All the time there were hidden players playing the role of terrorists, and then the security forces who are trying to sweep through the population by setting up checkpoints, arresting people, interrogating people, and so on. One of the lessons of the game was to sort of balance security versus economic disruption. The players had a population chip round their neck which represented the number of people under their control, and then they could hide weapon chips on their person if they were a secret policeman or were a terrorist. And the game really sort of was dual purpose in a way, which I think is its biggest weakness, in that one, it wanted to be a training tool to guide people on how to conduct a counterinsurgency when it's got to the terrorist, urban terrorist stage. But secondly, it also wanted to act as a laboratory to the developing new counterinsurgency tactics. As a result, it used quite a lot of note-taking and record-keeping during the game. Every turn, the players had to fill in a form suggesting, well, saying how they thought the game was going, how they thought they were doing, and who they thought would win, regardless of who they'd like to win. This generated quite a lot of data for further analysis at the expense of slowing the game down and breaking immersion. And I think that immersion in this sort of game is quite important. And obviously, a serious game without data collection is useless, but trying to balance the two contradictory aims is quite difficult, and something I think which is worthy of consideration going forward. So now we come on to the Taktspiel game. As we said, it was a tactical game, double blind, red team, blue team. Wasn't really a counterinsurgency game, as it explored the warfare sort of post Battle of Aydrang. So it's just light infantry versus light infantry, as I said, in difficult terrain. The combat system had asymmetries in it, as you'd expect, but the game itself was perfectly functional, but I think it came at the wrong time. The old Vietnam War historiography has the American army singularly unprepared to fight a counterinsurgency and favour a body count heavy approach over a population-centric one of political support and population support. However, there's been more nuanced modern work on the early stages of the Vietnam War, where the American army was needed to shore up the ARVN, who were getting regularly beaten in the field by Viet Cong main force battalions. So at this point, it is the right game, but the people who ran it failed to appreciate the change in Viet Cong tactics, because once the Americans entered the field, they de-escalated down the Mao escalatory ladder of insurgency, and the Americans didn't realise this. An examination of the large sweeping operations of 65 and 66 compared to 1967 will show this. The operations are the same, but the results a lot less. So, these games, why were they so successful at predicting what actually happened? Now, everybody wants their games to be predictive, but it's very easy to do it with hindsight and say where you went wrong and where you didn't. So how can you sort of bake this into your designs going forward? Small tactical events can be run many times, so you can get an average of a result, whereas big strategic events only happen once, and history only gives you one data point in that regard. So I think in this case, the most likely result is the one which games should try and produce, rather than rely on a random event swinging things. Obviously, you want to develop black swans and come up with situations which hadn't been thought of before, but this has got to be balanced with a question of realism and probability as well. So, why do they still matter today? There's historical significance. The games show how the US was thinking about the war and how it wanted to conduct the war and how wargaming helped it develop this. And there are lessons from each game which you can draw for your own professional practice on how to run a good game and how to watch out for possible pitfalls. And I think despite the current interest in peer and near-peer warfare, counterinsurgency warfare is going to be a feature going forward. It always has been, and it always will be. And especially after kinetic fighting has finished, there is often a period of instability where counterinsurgency techniques are needed to keep a lid on the violence once the main fighting has ended. And with that, thank you.